Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM and it is Monday the 2nd of October. Caoimhe Harney here with you until 3. Coming up first on today's show, we'll speak to Rosie Bissett, CEO of Dyslexia Association of Ireland. This week is Dyslexia Awareness Week, so we'll be giving you the signs to look out for if you think you or your child may be dyslexic. At 2:20, Suzanne Rogers, Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland, will be telling us about why Budget 2024 must make meaningful progress on child poverty. We'll hear at 2:35 about the latest winter vaccines that are now available from pharmacies this week. And then lastly, we'll hear about the dangers of becoming addicted to prescription medication and how to prevent that. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can call in 045 898 999. If you want to email me, it's studio@kfmradio.com, or you can send us in a WhatsApp or text.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, dyslexia is a learning disorder that involves difficulty reading due to problems identifying speech sounds and learning how they relate to letters and words. And this week, as I said, is Dyslexia Awareness Week. I'm joined on the line now by Rosie Bissett, CEO of Dyslexia Association of Ireland. Good afternoon, Rosie.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Rosie, I know I briefly mentioned it there in the outset, but talk us through dyslexia and what it actually is.
Okay, well, we would describe dyslexia as a learning difference, which can cause difficulties with aspects of learning and working. And as you mentioned, I suppose the most obvious sign when people think of dyslexia is someone who is having difficulty with learning to read, write and spell and being able to do that fluently and accurately. And particularly, as you say, often grounded in the ability to manipulate, I suppose, how well we map sounds and the sounds that make up words and then the letters, you know, or groups of letters that form the visual symbols. And I suppose we would also talk about dyslexia. It's quite common. It occurs affecting up to approximately 1 in 10, but very much on a spectrum. So it's very different for each individual. Some may be affected very mildly. With others, it's more significant.
Okay. One thing very important to note is that dyslexia does not mean that your child is less intelligent than someone else, because you could be the brightest person in the world and still have dyslexia.
Absolutely, yes. We've known this for a long time now, okay, that dyslexia, in fact, is not related to intelligence. So you can have someone at any level of intellectual ability. What we know essentially is that we need to stop making assumptions about someone's intellectual ability based on how well they can read and spell. And I suppose dyslexia really it confounds that assumption, you know, because as you said, you can be very intelligent, have lots of abilities in lots of other areas, but have this specific difficulty that really, I suppose, rears up and is most visible when it comes to dealing with literacy.
Okay. Is there any way to prevent dyslexia, or is there a cure for dyslexia?
No. And I suppose we wouldn't use those terms either, to be honest, because it's very much considered it's a brain difference. Okay?
Okay.
And that certainly, again, we know it is a learning difference. The dyslexic brain works and processes information differently. Okay. And also, I think if you talk to a lot of dyslexic individuals, it's seeing dyslexia is very much it can be a game of two halves. Yes, there are those challenges, but sometimes out of those challenges and difficulties that people face, they can also develop a lot of strength and resilience. They can get really creative in terms of solving problems, really good at dealing with people, you know, let's say in terms of their interpersonal skills. If you're not so good with reading, you might get much better at using your expressive skills, you know, and talking with people and being persuasive or accessing information in different ways like that. So we would never use the term, you know, a cure, because if someone is born dyslexic, they will always be dyslexic. Mm. But certainly its impact on them will change over time, depending on what environment they're in, what they're being asked to do, under what circumstances. You know, there may be huge parts of the day, week, where someone doesn't even, you know, it's not an issue, you know. But I suppose it's just, yeah, that it's very much linked with the environment and what someone is being asked to do at any given time as to how much of a challenge it is.
Okay. I would assume then, Rosie, that early assessment and intervention would be the best for outcomes in cases of dyslexia then.
Absolutely. And I suppose, and that's, you know, I feel like yet again, a big focus of what we're talking about, that, you know, in Dyslexia Awareness Month. getting access to assessment and getting that dyslexia identification is really important, not only for, I suppose, it's understanding what's going on for the individual, but it's also around giving them, an understanding of what's happening for them. It can also help them to access supports and accommodations that they may need. But as much as anything, it's about, almost that kindness and understanding that they can have. People sometimes say, oh, why would you get someone assessed? You're just giving them a label. But actually, what you're doing when you assess and you identify an individual with dyslexia is often you're relabeling them and you're taking away negative labels like stupid, low IQ, lazy, all of these horrible things that maybe someone has heard, thought about themselves, or unfortunately someone has said to them. It's actually going, no, you're not. You're dyslexic. There is a reason why certain aspects of learning, unfortunately very linked with literacy, are more challenging. But it's also about recognising that that's one part of the individual and that that person has their whole profile of strengths as well as those challenges,
And it's true what you say, Rosie, because I have heard that before where people say, oh, well, they got the diagnosis, or they got assessed and they're, it was a cop-out, or they used it to get exempt from such and such a subject, which obviously isn't a fair thing to say. If parents are listening in now and maybe they suspect that they might have dyslexia themselves, or maybe you're an adult listening, or even a young child, maybe they think even before their child has started school that they might have dyslexia, how do they look for the signs? What would you be looking out for?
Well, I suppose those signs will be different at different stages, okay? But I mean, the most obvious one is a child who is not picking up literacy and not picking up sounds, and in particular being able to, readily make those connections between the sounds that make up words and the letters that are on a page, So particularly, let's say, if a child has had, six 12 months in school, they've had a full year of being exposed to teaching of literacy and it's not clicking for them, then there's clearly something going on there, So like we'd always advise to parents to talk to the school and, express your concerns with them, and it may be that the school agree and can look at putting some supports into place. Usually in school, they operate sort of a staged model where they'll maybe try and put some interventions in place and see if that helps to resolve matters. If it doesn't, then you may be, stepping up, in terms of level of input and potentially looking at an assessment. But in reality, as many of your parents who've been down this road will know, getting an assessment through the school system is really, really challenging. It's very difficult. Schools will say themselves they get very few each year. So the reality is that the majority of individuals, be they children or adults, it would be seeking an assessment privately, which obviously then brings a cost and, is not an option for some people. Okay. So creates a lot of inequity.
We'll come back to that in a moment, Rosie, if you don't mind. If you are a teen or an adult, and it maybe perhaps it has gone, unnoticed until now, what would you be looking out for then in people who are older?
I think for individuals who are older, it's more usually around issues like the level of effort that they're putting in. So what we'd see a lot with older students, and sometimes we still see students in university where their dyslexia is only identified then, or obviously adults, is that oftentimes they've either developed strategies themselves whereby they're having to put in a huge amount of time, so much more time. So things like reading takes them much, much longer, or they maybe need to reread passages multiple times in order to be able to extract the meaning from them. And the same with persistent spelling difficulties, or maybe they become very, develop a reliance on technologies or tools or even individuals. There's a lot of great mums and partners out there in the world, who are really helpful in terms of proofreading and supporting individuals. But certainly for anyone of any age, and we assessed a gentleman into his 80s one time, I think at any age, it can be incredibly powerful to get an assessment, even if, for adults, sometimes it's not that. For some adults, they may not necessarily need the assessment for any particular reason. They may not be going back to education or college or anything like that. Sometimes it is literally just that independent confirmation from, the expert assessor to be able to say, yes, that's what it is. You are dyslexic, that was why it was so much more challenging for you, why you had to work so much harder, much longer hours to achieve, those results, which seem to come so much easier, to your siblings or your classmates or your colleagues in work even.
Okay. Back to the assessment then, for dyslexia, and if your child, say, is in primary school or secondary school and you suspect or they even might feel that they do have dyslexia, you're saying it's very difficult almost to get a diagnosed because you have to kind of jump through hoops. Like, what way does it work?
Okay, well, in the school system, it's NEPS, the National Education Psychological Service. So every school, in theory, has access to NEPS, the NEPS Psychological Service, but with like a limited number of kind of days and time available to each school. So most schools will tell you, look, the reality is they probably only get a couple of assessments done a year, you know, within their school. And schools, therefore, look, understandably, assessments have to be targeted to the kids having the most severe difficulties, you know. So, but at the same time, we know dyslexia is very common. It affects up to 1 in 10. So obviously there's a huge mismatch between the provision in terms of number of assessments versus the number of individuals who potentially need those assessments, you know. And NEPS, are, in fairness to them, are not fully staffed, you know, they're understaffed. And also they're not only assessing for dyslexia, they're assessing for other learning difficulties and also supporting schools in terms of practice and critical incidents and things like that as well. So there's a real mismatch in the public system between the availability of assessment versus the level of need. And then for adults, there isn't even an equivalent public assessment service for adults, you know, so they're left with very little option but the private route, or coming to ourselves, we'll say, for a reduced rate assessment, which we offer.
Okay, so if someone wants to go and get their child assessed, or else maybe themselves, what kind of money would you be talking about then in the private sector?
In the private sector, it varies a lot, but certainly anything from private assessments, you'd be talking 650 to 1,000, I would say, on average at the moment. With ourselves and the Dyslexia Association, we obviously operate as a non-profit. We charge 550, but then we also do a significant number of assessments at reduced rates, you know what I mean, at half or more even in terms of a subsidy for people who are on low income as well.
It's a huge amount of money for people, Rosie, isn't it? If you know, you could have a couple of children maybe who potentially might need to be assessed, and like it's a huge amount for families, especially now.
It's a massive burden for families, and I suppose, and that's why we're, as part of our campaign for Awareness Month, we actually have an Oireachtas briefing coming up on Wednesday, and I suppose one of the big ticket issues yet again is talking about the challenge of accessing assessment, you know. So really, I suppose, we're proposing two things. We need to, number one, certainly increase the number of assessments that are being provided through NEPS in schools. Mm-hmm. But we also need to look at how do we support those families who are left with no option but to seek private assessment, and to look for calling for government to provide some kind of support for families who have no option but to go privately in terms of a support for that. Another issue then as well is we're simply not training enough educational psychologists to do these assessments, you know. So like, if we really want to fix this problem, you know, we need to be significantly increasing the number of educational psychologists that we're training, so we have sufficient staff then to do these assessments.
Okay, how many more would you be talking? Like hundreds, thousands?
Well, certainly we could double or treble the number of people on the programme, I think, in terms of meeting the demand. I know from a recent PQ that NEPS, I think, is about... I think about 20% of posts unfilled in NEPS. There's also lots of, you know, both non-profits like ourselves and also then just private practice, you know, clinics doing assessments as well. And usually a lot of them are, you know, actively looking for staff at the moment. So I think certainly doubling or trebling the number of people, you know, certainly at least in the short term to begin to address the numbers issue, I think, really would be important.
Okay, and I'm just looking at your website here. Of course, people can head on over to it, Dyslexia Association of Ireland. And of course, there's a number here if people need it. I'll give it out now. It's 01877 6001. That's 01877 6001. And you can call that number, I'm sure, for more information about dyslexia. Rosie, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Rosie Bissett, CEO of Dyslexia Association of Ireland, marking Dyslexia Week this week. Thank you very much, Rosie.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Social Justice Ireland is calling for Budget 2024 to make meaningful progress on child poverty. And they say the recent increased political focus on child poverty is welcome, but also overdue. I'm joined on the line now by Suzanne Rogers, Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Good afternoon, Suzanne. Suzanne, tell us about what you want, I suppose, for Budget 2024.
Everything, I suppose, is probably the short answer to that. We are looking for a lot, but I mean, we were really encouraged that the Department of Taoiseach has established a Child Poverty and Wellbeing Programme Office. So that's a real acknowledgement that this is an issue, which is actually quite disturbing for Ireland in 2023, that one in every seven children is having to go without, is living in a household that is classed as living in poverty. So something should be done about that, and especially when, you know, the alternative conversation is that, you know, we didn't go into recession post-COVID. We bounced back in terms of unemployment and employment levels, that we have this, you know, surplus revenue tax take. So now really is the time to be looking at where are we spending our money, where are we putting our resources, who do those resources benefit? And it has to start with those children living in poverty. So the way they've laid out their programme office is sort of under six headings. So we've sort of copied that and sort of seen, okay, well, if they're going to look at income supports as being important, what do we think that they need to do in that space? So poverty is not just about money, but it's always about money. So for us, putting more money back into a household is really key. So an extra €25 in core weekly social welfare rates, an extra €50 in the child benefit, an increase in the weekly adult and weekly children's allowance and direct provision. The living wage, you know, needs to really reflect the living wage, which is $14.80 an hour now. And things like refundable tax credits, PAYE credits, you know, putting more money back into the households of people, especially those with children.
Okay, sometimes, Suzanne, when we talk about this and, you know, you list off what you people need, like it doesn't really hit home with people. From the work that you do with people on the ground, like, do you have any real stories of, you know, just how much people are struggling?
And I was at an event last week and it was really interesting because we had this, you know, huge cohort. We had organisations representing older people. We had organisations representing disabled people, carers. Carers is a huge issue in this country. And again, those, you know, living in poverty, and especially when you look at who's living in poverty and which children, it tends to be lone parent households. So that's key. But you've got things like St. Vincent de Paul had said that when the free school books were introduced last, so where are we now? What time? I've lost all, time has lost all meaning for me now, COVID, but yeah. the current back to school, like the amount of calls that they got looking for assistance with back to school costs dropped dramatically because households were able to get the free school books for primary. So these things do make a huge difference in people's day to day. But I mean, a real concern is that we've had, you know, again, record figures of children living in homelessness. And Temple Street in Dublin, it's a children's hospital in Dublin, like they've done reports of the amount of children who come through their doors because of where they're based. There's a lot of hubs and homeless hostels and B&Bs circulating around them. Children just, they're coming in and out with injuries because of where they live. It's a full family living in a small room. So scalds and burns, you know, pulling things down on top of themselves, cuts, bruises, because they've got nowhere to go. And they've seen things as well, like developmental delays with weaning because you've got nowhere to cook food, crawling, there's no crawl space. So there's a lot of developmental delays linked with this sort of poverty and having nowhere to call your own home and your family not being able to afford the basics. So it's quite disturbing, some of the stuff that they reported on.
Okay. Some of the other things that you're calling for in terms of early learning and childcare, an additional 2 weeks of paternity leave and an additional 2 weeks of paid parental leave, just some of the things there. Do you think that would go, you know, in a way to maybe help parents get off the ground?
I think so. I mean, you know, I know myself sort of trying to back on track after having a kid. I mean, the first year was just bananas. So any, I don't know what the correct medical term for that would be, but it's a really tough time adjusting to having this extra person in your house who demands 24-hour attention. So, you know, having that support at home, having the luxury of maybe not having to rush back to work at a particular time, all of those things, I think, again, they really help, because it's, you know, raising children, it's physical, it's mental, it's financial, it's emotional, it's all of those things, and supporting families to try as much as we can, I suppose, to, because child poverty is family poverty, and to be able to sort of support those families is really, really key. So all of these things add up, and that early childcare and early learning space is so important as well. Like, they've shown that the difference in sort of pupil-teacher ratios, you really make the difference the smaller the kids are. So that preschool and the first 2 or 3 years of school, if we can even just target the resources we have there, that's where teachers will pick up on the children maybe with dyslexia. That's where they're going to pick up on children with any additional needs, which would be great to pick it up as soon and as quickly as possible, because, again, that's where we can really make differences.
Okay. A big problem for people is access to services. They may know that they need, you know, help, but they don't know how to go about it. You're calling for additional funding for TUSLA, of course, the Child Protection Agency.
Yes, again, and you know, you can see where, especially if it comes to, you know, we've seen the headlines again all through the summer, parents of children with special needs weren't able to access school buses. Where do you go then? You know, it's those sort of things, the amount of children waiting for access to mental health supports. Again, if you're not getting the support you need, where do you go? So these things are really, really key. And I'm just so conscious that, you know, we talk about costs, but this is really an investment in the future of this country and in those children. I mean, at the moment, we have a 15-year-old future Taoiseach, we have a 15-year-old future senior council, we have a 15-year-old future policy analyst, and a 15-year-old future radio presenter. So, you know, to be able to, you know, really allow these children to flourish, access to services as well as that increase in income really will be key.
Okay, Suzanne Rogers, Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Thanks very much, Suzanne, for joining us this afternoon. Older people at-risk groups and health and care workers are being encouraged to get vaccinated from today. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Cathy Maher. She's a community pharmacist in County Meath. Good afternoon, Cathy.
Good afternoon, Cueva.
Cathy, this is being rolled out for people over the age of 50, and then the flu jab is for people over the age of 65.
That's right. So that's it. Even though today is quite a mild autumnal day, we are heading into flu season, and pharmacists and general practitioners around the country have been gearing up over the past couple of weeks to get their practices ready to deliver the flu vaccine and the COVID boosters where appropriate. What we do encourage people to do is, if they're in the at-risk group, and I can talk through that in a moment, is to get on to the pharmacy and book their appointment and have it done as early as possible in the season. It can take maybe for 2 weeks, up to about 2 weeks, for flu vaccination to be fully effective. So we encourage people to have the vaccine injected as early as possible to give themselves the most protection throughout the winter season.
Okay, so tell us about the at-risk group then.
So I suppose really when we think of anyone at risk, we usually think of those with chronic conditions such as diabetes, maybe cancer, immunocompromised positions, and some autoimmune diseases. Those that have, I generally categorise it, if someone has to attend a GP regularly, maybe once or twice a year at least, for a long-term condition, then they are at a higher risk of not only contracting flu, but also developing complications. And if the complications can be really troublesome and bothersome for people. We have to remember almost 200 people died last year alone just from influenza. So it's much more than a simple cold or a common cold. And it's really important that we do get those at-risk groups. So anyone that has a chronic condition, so if an age of 2 upwards and they have a chronic condition, anyone aged 2 to 12, so children in the age 2 to 12 age group bracket, they can avail of the free flu vaccine, which is a nasal spray for that age group. Anyone who is a healthcare worker like myself, or if you're caring for someone who has a chronic condition, anyone who is pregnant, there's a high risk of complication in pregnant women if they contract flu, and anyone who is housebound or in a residential care facility or in a nursing home, it's important that they get the flu vaccine as well. Anyone that works with some pigs and some fowl as well, some certain farm animals as well, it's important. But really what we need to remember is the earlier we get the vaccine, the more protection we have right through the winter season. Your listeners might remember last year's winter season was particularly difficult in terms of respiratory illnesses, and we were urging people to have the flu vaccine as early as possible to try and get the best protection, and we're asking for that again.
Okay, so people over the age of 65 for the flu jab, for sure, is what the advice is. What if they've never had it before and they're kind of thinking, well, I'm fully healthy, I'm fine, do I really need to get it if I'm never sick, you know?
We do, we hear that all the time, and we also hear, I don't want to get the flu vaccine because that will give me the flu. And we do hear that, and we do our best as healthcare workers to reassure people that certainly if you're over 65 and you've never had a flu vaccine or never had the flu, that's not to say it's never going to happen. And as we age, everything, our bodies do become older and we're more at risk of developing complications, so even a more serious infection from flu. So it's important that we do encourage those older age groups, even if they're young at heart, older age groups, to have their flu vaccine. For those that feel that the flu vaccine has given them the flu or cold before, it's really important to reassure that, number one, it's not a live vaccine, so we're not injecting flu into people. It's a deactivated strain. And this year's flu vaccine is, every year the flu vaccine is different to the season before. So this year, the four strains within this year's vaccine have been recommended by the WHO as the strains that are most likely to be in circulation this winter in the Northern Hemisphere. And then when that is injected into someone, what happens is your body produces antibodies that will help you fight those viruses should your body come into contact with them over the next number of months. And flu season, we were classed right up until the beginning of April.
Okay.
But with that vaccine, you will experience some side effects, and that's dependent. And it depends year to year, it depends on the person themselves. There will always be a little bit of soreness and redness and swelling around the injection site. And I know, certainly when I have it every year, you might forget, and maybe 48 hours later I think, God, what did I bump my arm? And then I remember I had the flu vaccine. It's that kind of just like a dull ache. You may have a mild fever, and that's okay. There may be a little bit of sweating and shivering, and that's okay. These are transient side effects. They tend to last maybe 24, 48 hours if you experience them, and there may be some general aches and pains. But your body is working really hard at this point to learn how to produce those antibodies to fight the flu should it come in contact with it. But if you experience any of those side effects, I would recommend rest and paracetamol. And be reassured, it's not the flu. The vaccine has not given you any virus whatsoever. Some people may have a little bit of a chesty cough in the intervening period, but it's more than likely that you've come into contact with another virus. And we are beginning to see in the community lots of respiratory viruses beginning to circulate. I am having more requests for advice around cough and cold in the past maybe 4 or 5 days than we have done up till now. So we are entering that season, and it's really important that people remember it'll take up to 2 weeks for the vaccine to become effective, so have it done as early as possible.
Okay, Cathy Maher, community pharmacist in County Meath. Thanks, Cathy, for joining us. Now, medication for severe or chronic pain, especially opioids, is potentially addictive, as are some antidepressants, especially when used over a long time without proper medical supervision. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Connor Harty. He's consultant in pain medicine at the National Orthopaedic Hospital in Kappa. Good afternoon, Connor.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for giving me the time to speak to you on this topic.
Delighted to talk to you. Tell us about, I suppose, just in general, how people can get addicted to these things.
I suppose our focus is on trying to make sure people are aware of the potential for this, although it is very rare, and it is very much the rationale for good opioid stewardship, and actually the focus of our push in recent times, particularly in relation to acute pain management and the use of these types of medications for that. The difficulty with addiction is we would look at it as a retrospective diagnosis. So it's something that is diagnosed only when it's established. So when someone has had suffered negative health benefits from it, negative health consequences from it, I should say, and they've already had problems in terms of employment or family. So it's too late once addiction is established. So what we want to do is make sure people are aware that these medications are useful in terms of acute pain and cancer pain and in certain circumstances, chronic pain. But there is a fine line for for people to run into trouble with these medications. We want to be very careful about how they're used.
Yeah, and one of the things I see listed as a possible, you know, reason is long waiting lists and people being left on medication because they're in such pain, but they can't get that sorted out because the waiting list potentially is 2 years, etc.
Yeah, waiting lists are a problem nationally, certainly in every specialty, and chronic pain is no different. The issue, I suppose, in terms of, from my point of view, is that when we have someone who has been established in opioids, we wouldn't withdraw them, certainly not in the short term. So it is a bit of work to try and reduce them. We would love to see better facilities at a community level for managing chronic pain, and I think most general practitioners would certainly agree with that. There has been an overuse of these types of medications because of a lack of alternative options. So you're correct in saying that waiting times do have a bearing on that. Nevertheless, chronic pain is a complex issue, and I wouldn't want to say that opioid addiction is entirely to do with long waiting times either.
Okay. I'm sure some people have seen the Netflix dramas, documentaries, Painkiller, Dope Sick, kind of telling the American stories of the opioid epidemic. Like, we don't see anything like that happening here, or would you foresee that? Like, it's not that bad at the moment, is it?
No, it definitely is not as bad as it has been portrayed in those documentaries. But those documentaries are not documentaries, but they're dramas, and they're quite accurate. Like, the scale of the problem in the US is enormous. You're talking about 645,000 people have died in 22 years from prescription opioid overdose alone. That's an enormous number of people. If you're in a younger age group, you're more likely to die of a prescription opioid overdose than you are of a car crash or a trauma. So, massive problem. However, we don't have the same scale of problem here. But nevertheless, if someone does run into addiction issues with these medications, it's devastating to that individual and that individual's family. So if we can cut down by one person, that's great. Having said that, if you're prescribed these medications and they're supervised, you shouldn't stop taking them without discussing it with your prescriber and doctor in the first instance. That's a really important message as well for your listeners.
Okay, we'll go to that in a second about, you know, what you can do maybe to, you know, if you think you're getting into trouble. Just in terms of over-the-counter, you know, medication, because obviously there's prescription and then you can buy things over-the-counter. Just on a personal level, I used to buy maybe Solpadeine or whatever for different things. And I noticed, like, in recent years, like, you're serious questioning very, I actually can't buy it anymore because they're very strict on who they'll give it out to.
Certainly there are people, we do see people who get addicted to codeine, and the difficulty is that when it's combined with other medications such as paracetamol or ibuprofen, so these can have devastating consequences if taken an overdose from liver and renal impairment. So the difficulty is it's very useful for someone like yourself who has a minor acute pain ailment, and they can be very effective. But the difficulty is, if they're freely available, we're leaving vulnerable people exposed to potentially dangerous medications. So it's a balance between the greater good and the benefit of the individual, and that's a societal dilemma.
Okay. In terms of then, if people are on prescription medication and perhaps are worried that, you know, they've been on it a very long time, what should they do if they're worried about getting addicted?
I think if someone's been established on a medication for a prolonged period of time, they're going to have a degree of tolerance. They're going to have a higher capacity to manage these medications. Addiction is different in the sense that it describes a compulsive use and a chaotic use and a poor control. So if someone's using them not as prescribed, they're looking for more and more medications to get the same benefit. They're the kind of things we're concerned with, and that's absolutely, you should bring that to the attention of your prescriber, and that's where things maybe need to be modified or adjusted or even assessed. The important thing from the point of view of someone who's on them long term is really good hygiene around it. So that means taking them only as they were prescribed. If there's any changes, to making sure that the prescriber is aware, making sure these medications are locked up. They're quite dangerous, and the people who get addicted aren't necessarily the ones who are prescribed, but they're family members of the person who is prescribed the medication. They may be taken for legitimate or illegitimate reasons, but if these medications are diverted, so taken by teenagers or whatever of a grandparent or a parent, that's when we really see huge problems with these medications. And that's the source of a huge number of addiction cases in the US in particular.
Okay, so absolutely do not share your prescription medication.
Correct.
Okay, that's all we have time for today. Unfortunately, Dr. Conor Harty there, consultant in pain medicine at the National Orthopaedic Hospital in Kappa. Thanks very much, Dr. Harty, for joining us this afternoon. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow.